It's 18th. Welcome to Senate Finance. Welcome to the table, Senator Green, Senator Bundy, Senator Olson just dragging in. Good morning, sir.
Good morning.
Senator Hoffman and Senator Dyson. And visiting senators this morning, Senator Cowdery from Anchorage, Senator Stevens is back with us from Kodiak, and Senator Stedman from Sitka and Ketchikan, Southeast Alaska. I can't tell which is more beautiful this morning. These daffodils, or my co-chair. I just don't know.
I was really nervous because he was looking at Dyson when he said that.
You're blushing this
morning. And what I was nervous about is there may have been a change in co-chairs.
I know. Well, maybe there's a coup right. In progress.
And I've been joined by Senator Wagoner this morning, too, from Keene, I saw that in the morning, Tom. Let's see, three things this morning. We have till 11. First, we're going to have Mr. Dan Cuddy has joined us this morning. Administration has asked for him to come and visit with us this morning, and we'll ask him to come to the table first. And then Neil Freed from the Department of Labor, a well-known economist and public speaker, is going to join us and talk a little bit about the Alaska economy. Neil was scheduled for Monday morning, and of course, his plane overflew, so he's back with us this morning. And then when we finish those two presentations, then we're going to take a look at the next iteration of SJR3 having to do with the constitutional spending limit. And Senator Dyson said he needed about 20 minutes on that. So it sounds like we can get all this in by 11 o'clock today. And let's see if there's anything else come for the committee. Senator Bundy?
I just wanted to point out for the record, we have a letter from the Department of Revenue addressing some of our previous conversations, but in the second paragraph there's a very interesting sentence that I would like to share with the public. In December 1985, Governor Sheffield submitted his FY87 budget based on the forecasted unrestricted revenues of $2,719,000,000. In today's dollars, that would be $7.2 billion. So as we talk about the numbers we talk about today, it's interesting to index those against the numbers that folks were talking about in 1987.
Thanks, Senator Bundy, and thanks for pointing that out. You do have that letter from Commissioner Corbis that is in response to some questions that we had 2 days ago during his presentation. You also have two proposed amendments to the Constitution from Mr. Cremo as he visited with us yesterday, and then also your handout, Mr. Freed's presentation, which he'll show you shortly. Anything else come before the committee before we begin? Let's then begin our deliberations today and ask Mr. Dan Cuddy to come to the table. Dan? All right, sir. You bet. Take your chair. Thanks for joining us this morning, and welcome to Senate Finance. The floor is yours, and we look forward to hearing from you.
Well, I thank you for giving me the opportunity to come and speak to you. What I want to talk to you about is the cost of paying for state government. The state of Alaska is not facing a fiscal crisis. Resources are currently available pay the cost of government, thanks to the higher price of oil and the state royalty. And state royalty income is much higher than expected.
Mr. Cuddy, can I interrupt you just a second? I'm almost embarrassed to ask you this, but for the record, would you identify yourself so that your voice matches up with your name when they record these?
My name is Dan Cuddy. I've lived in Alaska all my life. I am president of the First National Bank, Alaska.
Thank you.
I live in Anchorage.
Thank you. Go ahead, please.
Let's see, where was I? Thanks to the higher price of oil, state royalty income is much higher than expected. And thanks to the wisdom of the legislature in making judicious use of the constitutional budget reserve, there are ample reserves in addition to the income of the permanent fund of the state of Alaska. And there are more than ample resources to pay for it. Any proposed version of the next state budget. However, that does not solve the current problem, which is uncertainty. Uncertainty now is contributing to what has become more than a fiscal gap in the future, what will become a true crisis of major proportions. If the legislature does not do something now to avoid it, there is uncertainty now in the financial markets of Alaska's future. There is uncertainty among the oil producers, who contribute to the bulk of the state revenue in the form of royalties. Same can be said of other resource extraction enterprises. And there is uncertainty among your constituents about the economic future of Alaska in light of the potential for seemingly unlimited government spending. At present, the bond rating of the state of Alaska remains relatively stable. Financial markets look to the constitutional budget reserve and the permanent fund as security for the payment of the cost of state government, including bond indebtedness. The decision of the markets about Alaska's credit worthiness will change quickly for the worse if the budget reserve is further depleted, or you show a reluctance to resort to income from the permanent fund to pay for anticipated costs of state government. Worse yet, if the state of Alaska does something permanently to make the permanent fund income unavailable to pay for part of the cost of the state government when needed. Deterioration of the state bond rating will, of course, increase the expense of bonded indebtedness, the cost of funding state government. What makes matters worse is that the ratings will be deteriorating at the same time that interest rates are generally increasing. I can't tell you specifically how much interest rates will increase in the next few years or precisely when they will start to go up. But everyone with any knowledge about the current national economic circumstances will confirm to you that interest rates will be on the rise. They can't go any lower. If not at the conclusion of national elections, and certainly as the national trade deficit increases and the value of the dollar declines against all other major currencies. The impact on the cost of funding state government will doubly be bad unless you act to bring certainty to the fiscal situation now. That includes the source of state income for appropriation and the cost of state government. Talk now of a change in the state tax laws affecting oil and gas producers in the state is causing them to rethink of the strategy in Alaska. I assure you that changes in the current tax laws affecting oil producers will cause them to spend their resources for oil and gas elsewhere. All the time when Alaska can least afford any further decline in oil and gas revenue. Drive a harder bargain in connection with future oil and gas development if you think it prudent. That will allow producers to plan development. Changing what is in effect a bargain that already exists will cause them to abandon development in Alaska. Same can be said of miners. Whether it be oil or gas or other mineral extractions, development and return on investment involves a long-term process, one that will go forward unless variables are reduced to a minimum. If producers cannot count on a stable tax structure for the life of an oil field or a mine, they won't begin to develop it in the first place. By changing Alaska's current bargain with the producers, you will jeopardize the prospect of further development and jeopardize revenue that is critical for the state of Alaska in the future. And there is also just as much uncertainty among your constituents. As long as there is no stated strategy for funding the state government and no plan for limiting state government expenditures, there will be no potential economic development in the state of Alaska. And as long as there is a common perception that no potential for economic development in the state of Alaska, the state will encounter the same cycle of booms and busts that we've had forever. including the same transient population that has been constant in Alaska. There will be no economic development or growth of business in Alaska able to sustain the anticipated costs of state government as long as there's a threat of broad-based tax on an unspecified amount. And there will be an immediate demand by your constituents for distribution of all the income of the permanent fund as long as there is no articulated strategy for funding state government, and even more so, so long as there's a potential check on state spending, as long as there's no potential check on state government spending. I'm sure it occurs to you that there is no recorded success of any government fostering economic development by instituting or increasing an income or sales tax. And further economic development is what this state needs to establish a stable source of income to pay for the cost of state government. Just putting an end to uncertainty now about the extent and means of paying for state government will be a valuable contribution to the state of Alaska. I warn to you that it will reduce the cost of borrowing to pay for state government and further economic development in the state, certainly in connection with resource extraction. It will also create a more favorable climate for small business and will attract and keep industrious people in the state of Alaska, encourage our children and their children to live and work in our state. Well, like everyone else, I think you can better than just bring about certainty. I have my own suggestion for a strategy. A lot of it is based on history, and thankful I have a lot of history in this state. I know because I was here. The permanent fund was created so there'd be a source of revenue to pay for a portion of the state of the state government when revenues from oil production declined. No, not the principal portion of the fund, but the income from the fund. Likewise, I know because I was here that the dividend program was instituted when there seemingly was no effort whatsoever to limit the state spending of the government state spending. Since folks thought the only thing that could limit the state government spending was a limit on available revenue for appropriation, the idea to pay a portion of that income of the permanent fund directly to Alaskan residents was born, by means at least some limit of government spending could be imposed. You can still achieve all these objectives by judiciously avoiding appropriation of permanent fund earnings and inflation-proofing the fund. You have provided a stable source of income to pay a portion of the cost of state government and to pay a dividend to the citizens of Alaska as well. Trustees and staff of the permanent fund have done their job well by judiciously investing the principal and a portion of the annual income of the fund. There is now a source of revenue for the state as well as dividends. The percentage of market value approach to management of permanent fund earnings should be adopted. It has been the successful means of managing many other endowments, and there's every reason to believe that it'll be equally as successful means of managing our permanent fund. What's even more important is that the increases, increase in certainty of revenue available to pay the portion of the cost of the state government and the permanent fund dividend. We have seen the potential dramatic effect on the availability of revenue of the current approach to management of the fund. Distributions based on realization of earnings are always a function of the vagaries of the market and notion of current investment managers. The percent of market value approach evens out these variables over a rolling 10-year period that lends to predictability to avail revenue and a degree of certainty that the financial markets demand. And if there's any stability to the cost of funding state government, this is the best manner to do it. How income is divided between state government and residents should be left to the legislature to decide. State legislature should have the opportunity to determine the use of all available state income as well as state spending. The legislature can maintain that control if it adopts a plan for the division of the earnings of the permanent fund and limiting state spending. An articulate plan to limit the budget increases according to an identical index will go a long ways to quell the uncertainty among dividend recipients. Also, assuming a percent of market value approach to the management of the permanent fund and a plan for limiting budget increases according to an index, the permanent fund recipients will have some degree of certainty not only that a dividend will be paid, but also the amount of the dividend payment they expect from time to time. One additional benefit of bringing about a degree of uncertainty now in respect to fiscal matters is that it will give the legislature time to deal with a far greater problem that will appear in the future. That problem is the unfunded liability for pension and welfare benefits that'll be owed to the state and municipal employees in the next 10 years. In my view, there's a deficit now in available resources to pay those obligations. My prediction is that the liability will grow worse if the matter is left untreated, and I expect that there will soon be more retired government employees entitled to benefits than working employees. Once again, I thank you for the opportunity to come before you.
Thank you, Mr. Cuddy.
Questions? Yes. Senator Dyson.
Thank you for bringing us some of your wisdom and for the contribution your family has made to our state. I'm intrigued by a couple of your comments, and I'd appreciate if you'd comment a little more on how a spending limit would encourage investment?
Well, at the present time, there's great uncertainty in the business community and in the individuals as to the financial condition of the state of Alaska. They speak of the budget shortfall and the increased spendings, and they talk of income tax and of a sales tax, and the rating of the permanent fund. I think we need to bring some certainty to that. And what I suggest is that the permanent fund income go to the legislature for appropriation. And that would take care of the uncertainty.
If I may continue, I assume that the line of reasoning is that if there legislature spends a lot more money and increases its budget, and then there isn't the revenue to pay for that, that business investors would be apprehensive that the legislature would increase taxes on industry and business, thinking that they had the deep pockets. And so that's the perspective that would limit their investing more here.
That, of course, is the uncertainty of which I speak.
I thought so.
You're correct. Absolutely correct.
Okay. Can you think of places, sir, that we can find in the record that the permanent fund dividend was put in place just to restrain, as a primary mode, just to restrain government? I think you're right, but
all I can think of is my memory back when it was adopted. We had all the great monies flowing from the oil at that time, and the population figured that if we could take the money from the legislature, they wouldn't spend it. And that's when the dividend was established.
Thank you.
Other questions of Mr. Cuddy?
Thank you.
Thank you, sir, and thank you on behalf of the committee for all you've done for your thousands of employees and for the thousands of people, hundreds of thousands of Alaskans. Thank you for being here this morning. We've been joined by Senator Stevens and Senator Seekins. Let's see, next we're going to go to Mr. Freed. Neil, good morning. Please join us. And will it just be you?
Yes.
It's been said that if you lay all the economists in the world end to end, they still can't reach a conclusion. But that's not the case with Neil. He reaches conclusions. He does it frequently and takes a dry subject and brings it home. So welcome to Finance. And administration has asked that you're here to brief us a little bit on the Alaska economy. So the floor is yours.
Good morning. Thank you. It's a real pleasure to be here. I was basically asked to give a presentation looking at the 1980s and sort of context with our current economy in Alaska. I was told to share 36 slides with you, and as an economist, like you said, if you learn, head-to-head, or many people say that we should have learned in two rooms, I doubled that number of slides to 12, but I can get through these slides in probably about 12 or 13 minutes. Because I know your time is of the essence. The first slide I wanted to show you is a slide that I actually showed to most people that I present to, a variety of groups around the state. And this is really sort of our economic history since statehood, and I could talk about this one particular slide for hours and hours, but I promise I won't. I just really want to make two points here, given the subject that we're talking about. And that is, very often Alaska is described as a boom-bust economy. And you can see that since statehood, we've really only had one bust, and that was the one that's indelibly marked in our collective economic memory, etched very, very deeply. And that was, of course, in 1986. That lasted for at least 3 years, and for some industries lasted a lot longer. And then the other point I just want to make with this slide is we've just completed our 16th year of uninterrupted economic or employment growth in this economy. And you can see how different this period of much more moderate growth has been compared to all the previous decades. And actually, the next slide, I think, makes that point a lot better. And this is sort of northern U.S., although it looks very impressive. This is average annual growth, employment growth, 6% a year for the past three decades, ending in 1985. That's pretty impressive growth. Even in the 1980s, when you think about it, our economy is a lot bigger than it was in the 1960s, and we still achieve that kind of growth, growing more than two to three times as fast as the rest of the country. And then when you look at sort of the current period that we're in, this period that began in about 1990 to the current, to the present, we've grown about a little shy of 2% a year. So a very, very different environment than we had in the previous decades. And that tells a lot about how things have changed since the 1980s and how things have changed actually over the long run. This is a slide, since the subject of the 80s, real estate was a very big issue in the 1980s, both in the run-up and the dramatic increase in our growth in our economy and the dramatic decline in our economy. And the reason why I put this graph together, in fact, was because a couple of years ago, people noticed in the sort of the rail belt part of the state that there was sort of an increase in housing construction going on, and because of the experience of the 1980s, people were a little nervous about it, because we do remember these times that most people that at least were here during that period were touched by it and remember these times quite well. They weren't worried about the economy, in fact. They thought that the sign of increased housing construction was somehow sort of scary. And so I finally put this graph together just to look at perspective, and what you can see here is in 1983, about 9,000 new residential permits were issued in Anchorage, and that's more than the number of units that have been permitted during the last 5 years. A very, very different time. I think this slide does provide a lot of perspective. And this, of course, is in an economy that's considerably larger than it was back in the mid-1980s. And of course, I have to admit that in the 1980s, it was very hard to really count our population because it was changing so fast. In fact, and this next slide is sort of the same story, looks very much like the slide. It's just for the Fairbanks North Star Borough. And you could repeat this in the Mat-Su Borough, which would be probably even more dramatic, in many of the Rail Belt communities, and some communities outside of the Rail Belt as well. I just think it sort of lends some perspective on the 80s compared to today. But of course, it wasn't just real estate that was affected. And I'll talk a little bit more about that. I mean, it had, just a reminder, you can see these numbers of foreclosures, and most of us remember this experience. You know, the experience of the person that returned the keys back to the bank who had made the effort to at least mail it back to the bank. People were actually thankful for that, because most people didn't do that. And, you know, for example, condos, believe it or not, during this period peaked at the average condo price, peaked in 1985, I think, at about $100,000. And by 1987, 88, they had fallen to about in the 30s, about 30, 34,000. Just sort of an example of what kind of happened during that period of time. There are all kinds of other dramatic statistics that describe the housing market of the 1980s. But it wasn't just the housing market that was affected. Obviously, it was the overall economy. And you can see on the run-up and the growth, there were years in the 80s where we grew by over 10,000. We haven't achieved that since then, even though our economy right now employs over 300,000 people, considerably larger. But on the downside, the red bars, as you can see, we've lost basically 20,000 jobs during that economic crash. The biggest loss our economy has ever lost, at least since we started keeping good statistics, beginning with statehood. And this just tells us, we lost 10,000, it almost looks symmetrical. We lost 10,000 jobs in 86 and 10,000 jobs in 87. But the other part of the story that's not told is, of course, it took a number of years. It was not until the early to mid-1990s where our economy came back to where it was in the peak years of the late, or about 1985, which was the peak year for employment and most other activity, with the exception of housing. Housing actually peaked in a couple of years prior to that. Now, the industry that got hit the hardest, and those of us who experienced this, you know, this isn't new. Half of the jobs lost in our economy at that time were in construction. Construction today, there are fewer people employed in construction today, in absolute terms, in an economy a lot larger than there were in the 1980s. But it wasn't just the construction industry, and it was that was hit hard. And you could even say that construction sort of led the boom and also led the bust. In the 80s, but other industries got hit as well. Retail, FIRE, that stands for finance, insurance, and real estate, which some people felt was a pretty good acronym in the 1980s, especially in 86 and 87 and 88. And from a relative standpoint, that hit was probably as large to that industry as it was, as the hit to construction was. You know, we lost 15 financial institutions in the state during that period of time. It occurred all the way through the mid-1990s when that happened. Services were lost. You know, we always thought the service sector was pretty much insulated from recessions, and it certainly wasn't. Transportation, state government, local government. So it cut across most industries during that 2 to 3 year period. Next slide, I just thought I should spend a few more seconds with construction. And it's interesting because the 80s, the early 80s were sort of a mirror image of the late 80s, just in a different direction. But construction is now playing a much different role than it did in the previous decades. It's more accommodating to the economic growth that has occurred in Alaska's economy. Since then, it's grown very predictably, and its influence on our economy is certainly not nearly as dramatic as it was in those previous decades. That's just employment growth by year. In other words, you know, it's amazing to see these numbers, that in 1983, construction employment grew by 30%. And nowadays, if it grows by 4 or 5, that's pretty impressive. Now, this looks like a lot like the construction employment, actually. And it almost looks like we're looking at the same statistics, but we're not. We're looking at migration here, net migration, which all that means is taking the number of people that are leaving and the number of people who are entering the state, subtracting the two, and that's what you come up with. In other words, in 1983, approximately, we increased our population in Alaska through migration increased by about 26, 27,000 people. You know, we during that period, I think between 45 and 55,000 were moving into the state, and something less than that was moving out of the state every year, which you can see that this is a period of the strongest population growth in our history and in raw numbers. And then you can see the accompanying decline. It wasn't quite as large. I think we gained about 125,000 people during that period of time, and which is, you know, even in today's standards, is very impressive with a population of about 637,000 in our current population. And we saw that tremendous outflow of population. And now we've seen, as you can see, as we all know, it's been a much more moderate period of small net increases and small net out-migration for the state. Overall, our population has grown by about 1% a year in the last 10, 15 years. Very different environment. And this is just sort of tells that sort of historical story. This is just the 10-year growth, the decennial census that tells us this every 10 years. And you can see just the difference. In 1990, for the first time, or that previous decade, it was the first decade since, I believe, the 1920s, that Alaska grew about the same rate as the rest of the country. And I'm getting down to my last slide, and some of you may be wondering, why am I showing this? You know, I think another big change, our economy has changed a lot since the 1980s, but so have our demographics in so many different ways, and I think it's, you know, sort of very important, especially when we look into the future. You can see that in 1980, the median age, which means that half the people in the state were younger than 26 and half were older, and probably in 82 or 83, the median age was probably even younger than 26 because we had such a huge influx, and people who move tend to be young. The biggest group that moves are those that are between the ages of 18 and 29. But you can see how much older we are today, our median age in the state. And we're getting closer and closer to national average, although we still tend to be younger than the rest of the country. And I think that has some economic implications as well when we think about our economy and what could happen and how we might react to a large economic event. And I think my last slide also helps tell the story. And this isn't, you know, this is real data. I didn't just make this data up on Chichacos. The Census Bureau doesn't use that term. But every 10 years, One question they ask people in this state is, where did you live 5 years ago? And in 1960, nearly half of the people in this state had lived in a different state or a different country. In other words, they had lived outside of the state in 1960, a very footloose population. And we still remain relatively footloose compared to the rest of the country. But you can see by 2000, when they asked that same question, it had dropped to 19%. So what does that mean? Well, I mean, it can mean lots of different things. There's probably positives and pluses in that change, but one thing it certainly means is there are far more multi-generational families. We aren't nearly as footloose, probably, as we were in the 1980s. And I suspect that also has some sort of important economic implications about our economy and how we'd react to a relatively large economic event. And those are all the comments I have. I'll be glad to entertain questions.
Thank you, Ms. Reed. Comments, Senator Bundy?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Reed. Several years ago, I think the Department of Labor shared a graph, something like this, about the composition, the demographics of Alaska and what was projected to be in about 2015. If I remember correctly, and I hope you'll remind me or accurately improve my accuracy on this, the vast majority of Alaskans were to be over age 65 and under age 5, and the smallest portion of our population by a significant percentage would be the age 30 to 50. In other words, the producers were going to be a very small part, and we were going to be sort of an inverted pyramid, with those who have already retired or were too young to work were going to be supported by a very small population. Is my memory faulty on that?
No, not altogether. I mean, what the group that is growing the fastest, you know, the fastest rate of growth is happening to that population over 65. In other words, and we talk about dependency ratios, both dependency ratios for children, for people over 65, and that dependency ratio is definitely increasing. I'm not sure it'll be that inverted. I mean, it is becoming more inverted, but I'm not sure it'll be that dramatically inverted. I don't know, Chris might be able to answer that question better, although we just came out with our new population overview with the newest data on our population. But I think generally speaking, you characterized it correctly.
Mr. Chairman, if I might continue, I'd like to see the new information when it comes out, because it really has an impact on what we do, I think, when we consider revenue and taxes. And if we're going to try to support the state on taxes, particularly an income tax from those that are working, if they're a small minority of the population, the tax is going to have to be pretty significant.
I mean, I think it will be a smaller percent of the population, but it's still, I think, going to be the largest piece of the population.
One other thing, if I might, and again, related to income tax, we often hear the rationale that we've got to get those non-resident workers in. And again, I've used some of data from you folks, and I want to make sure that I'm up to date on that about 90% of the wages earned in Alaska are earned by Alaskans, and that the average yearly wage for non-residents is around $13,000 or $14,000 a year. And am I accurate on that?
The average wage is considerably below the average wage of the average Alaskan. And 90%, I think you are correct. As far as the actual absolute amount, I'm not sure. Yeah.
Again, those numbers would be valuable if you get a chance to get them. Thank you.
Senator Bundy, and before we go, Senator Dyson, would you mind following up on Senator Bundy's assertion? I think we all pretty much know that it's about 10% earned income is from people that live outside Alaska. But the other part of that that we don't talk about is that $13,000 number. I wonder if could you look at that and see how close he is and come back with a number?
Yes, yes. Yeah,
that's an interesting follow-on to the 90-10 issue. Senator Dyson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is the average wage of the non-resident worker, has that fallen significantly? I assume it did since the pipeline days, but has it fallen significantly?
I don't know.
Wages have been fairly stable.
And if you adjust them for inflation, I would suspect they probably have fallen, like overall wages have.
And second, is there any reason to not assume that the trends that you have shown us and shown us well, any reason to think that those won't generally continue?
You mean the demographic trends?
Demographics and the age and job gains and losses.
I think the demographic trends will stay the same unless something very dramatically happened. You know, the age, we will continue to age unless, you know, we, for example, had a huge economic boom and attracted lots of young people, which is always a possibility, which happened in the 80s and has happened in previous decades. But it's less likely, and a boom would be a smaller proportion of, you know, would have less effect on our economy than it did in previous decades because we've gotten larger. As far as the continued moderate growth, I mean, predicting the economy is more difficult than demographics, and so that's more difficult to, you know, we could easily be lulled into the fact that we've had 16 years of this sort of uninterrupted moderate growth, and so we, you know, sort of continue to assume that that's probably going to continue to happen, but, you know, things can change.
Do you, thank you, do you track our gross state?
We track it. We use it as sort of another economic indicator. It's a very, very blunt economic indicator, and it tells some of the stories it tells are very important, and other stories it's, you have to be very careful with its use, because the price of oil has such a huge impact on the gross state national product. If you actually looked at those figures alone and nothing else, it would look like our economy has not grown at all in a long, long period of time. And it has a lot to do with the production of oil and the value of oil.
Yeah, and I appreciate that. And if you could fairly easily, from data you already have, I would really enjoy seeing a graph that shows our gross state product and the component of that that's driven by the vagaries of oil prices and production rates. And I suspect most of the committee would enjoy seeing that as well. Thank you.
Chris Miller is here from the Department of Labor. Chris, do you want to join us? He's from the Research Division. Is there anything you'd like to share with us or any questions that we may ask of Chris? He's a wealth of knowledge. Anything you'd like to add to the discussion that we're having?
No, other than to, Chairman, other than to reaffirm.
Identify yourself, Chris, if you would.
Chris Miller, Chief of Research with the Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development. To reaffirm Neil's statements about the demographics of our population. Like the nation, the baby boom generation is aging out. Following that is what a generation called Gen X. That's a much smaller group of people, followed by the children, or the boomlet, if you might speak. So that's the issue as far as the labor market that's going to be facing the state and the nation as well, is that they're going to be in that window of working people. There's going to be a valley temporarily as the baby boom generation ages out and the boomlet folks enter into the labor force. There's a valley in there between the two. Of fewer workers.
Senator Green?
No, doesn't that also translate to predicting the number of students in school districts, need for new school construction, and continuing to expand what you have, thinking your current numbers are going to continue to grow? And even though your population may stay steady, and you would anticipate an equal number of students continuing, that percentage goes down.
Chairman, that'd be very true. You do need to watch closely the cohorts, as we talk about it, or those age groups. The age cohorts, you need to look at the children coming up and those numbers, because right now they are growing, and they will grow, but it's a smaller number than our generation just passed.
Other questions? Senator Olson, did you have a question?
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I'm not sure how to go ahead and ask it, but I will kind of phrase it in a way that you might be able to interpret it, since it's been a question that was on the point that Senator Bundy asked. And I understand that 10% of the population are non-resident, they get an average of whatever it happens to be. What I would like to know is how many people, and reason for that is we have such a population that's only here for part of the year, essentially part-time employees. I'd like to know what the average wages of those people are here during the whole year, or during a period of the year where they're, I guess, during the most of the year. Do you understand the question? Where you kind of get rid of all the people that are doing the service-oriented jobs, as opposed to those that are here professionally and are here year-round.
The average wage is for the entire economy is in the mid 30,000 range, whereas seasonal workers are in the mid 20s.
And if you took all that away, all the seasonal workers that are essentially part-time people, what's the average wage of the person that stays here or lives elsewhere? I'm sure you don't have the answers now.
No, I don't have the answer now.
I'm looking for the answers when you come up with.
It's sort of hard to, because there's some industries where the wages tend to be higher, like in oil and construction, which tend to be also seasonal, but then you have fish processing, which is extremely seasonal and pretty large, where the wages tend to be very low.
And many service industries are also, right. In support of tourism, don't tend to have high wage.
That's why I want that excluded. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Before we go to Senator Hoffman, Senator Prince has joined us. Good morning, Hollis. Thanks for being here. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. During the same time period from 1980 to 2000, what about family size? How has that changed over the last two decades?
Family size has come down some. And the demographics have changed. I mean, there are more single families, there are more, in other words, the percent of families with children have dropped off as our population ages, and fertility has dropped off some as well, although it sort of has leveled off, I think, in recent years.
How does that compare to the national average?
We still are more fertile than the national average, and our average family size is still larger. And our average household size is also larger.
Mr. Chairman, I think someone yesterday, one of the members of the public, mentioned the breeders in their testimony.
Thank you, Senator Bundy, for sharing that with us. Senator Green.
This is sort of off task, but one of the things that we deal with each year, as well as everyone who's involved in the budget processes and planning, and as we look to the future and all, we use one. What we should be doing, how should we be going about our budget process? Have you, in your wisdom, all the information you have ever found any other indicators that lead you to add on to the price of a barrel of oil for what's going to happen over the next 12 months as far as income production or revenue for the state? I think we have a very fairly poor track record of the forecast versus the actual and the with all due respect to everyone in the room. It is the nature of the beast, but we tie all decision-making to that. Is there anything else that we could add to that prediction to make what we do and what everyone in the budget process does more accurate, more, any easier?
Well, you know, we're biased. We're from the Department of Labor, and we produce employment data and population data. So, of course, we think those are very, very, very good economic indicators. I'm not sure how you might use them, but, you know, they tend to be, in many cases, a better indicator of what is happening to our economy than gross state product or even the price of oil.
It's an agreement.
Are there formulas or ways to factor in that information, or like, I mean, because I think some of the more recent past shows a very steady, you know, not the volatile action of, say, the 80s or even the late 80s, and it's just very steady in the reliability of maybe not only the data, but also of the workforce and the people here. Is there any way to bring that in, or do we just have to still go back to where the dollar comes from, and that's all we can deal with?
Chairman and Senator Green, it makes a little bit of a difference when you're talking, as Neil says, when you're talking about population trends and our workforce trends, or who's in the labor force, because that's people. They react more slowly than other international economic events, which are out of our control and unfortunately sometimes have a very significant impact on the value of our natural resources. Mm-hmm. And very often they are unpredictable bolts of lightning out of the sky. And so in one sense, Neil and research analysis can do fairly well at predicting workforce needs, but the value of the product is open to other vagaries that are much more difficult to predict.
Thank you.
Other questions from finance members about visiting senators? Senator Wagoner?
Bring
chair with me. Bring your own chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a short question, Mr. Fried. On your first slide, you showed the growth in jobs.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a way that you can do an overlay on that and show us also the trend in the number of jobs per year and the average income of those jobs? What I'm getting at, you know, in the last 15 years, we've had a tremendous increase in box stores, lower paying jobs, jobs without benefits necessarily, which puts another level of pressure on the government to provide services. I'd like to see a graph like that if we could. I think it'd be kind of interesting to make the comparison.
I actually show a graph to people a lot. One is a graph of comparing our average annual wage to the national average, and I think even by 94, 95, we still, you know, we're about 28% above the national average, somewhere in that arena. And today we are basically average with the nation.
Well, it's come down.
You know, relative to the rest of the nation, it's come down. Now, the cost of living, you could argue, is also, there's been a narrowing in that arena as well.
Right.
But that has been a very significant trend in our economy. And as you implied, a lot of it's because of the change in the occupational and industry mix in our economy.
You know, I guess my point is job growth is great, but you've got to break that down and look at what type of jobs are there and what are growing and what impact it has on the government. I'd like to get those charts from you if I could. Please.
Yeah,
thank you.
Certainly do that.
Other questions from visiting senators? Senator Stebbins?
I was wondering if you can address how you calculate and fit in the fishing industry in your analysis of wages, because some of the times the meetings I've been to in the past, that whole industry is deleted because some folks think it's too complicated to calculate, and it has a huge impact in Southeast Alaska and actually throughout the state in Kodiak and out in the Aleutians, all our coastal communities, and I'd like you, if you could, to address that.
Senator, you're correct. Fish harvesting is a significant part of our economy. Unfortunately, by definition, our industry data are non-agricultural, so that we, in our routine data collection that we do in cooperation with the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics, we do not include them. However, we are working with the Fish and Game Commercial Fisheries Division to set up a process where we can make estimates of the employment that is going on in the harvesting sector of the seafood processing industry. We have had some initial reports that activity is not complete, but we are working towards getting better information on that activity. Department of Fish and Game does have information on revenue from that sector.
Would it be possible to bring back some information of the percent of the economy that the fishing industry comprises within Alaska, even if it's a rough estimate?
And that would be possible.
And then one other quick thing, and then I'll yield the floor. Several years ago, there were substantially higher prices within the industry, and I think most people in Alaska realize that particularly the salmon industry has been really hard hit. And I'm just wondering what effect that'll have on your more recent data on income throughout the state. I don't expect it to be statewide to be large, but it should have an impact that would push down some of the average earning estimates.
We are seeing, at least anecdotally and in the some of the overall data, that trend, price of fish dropping, many folks getting out of the industry entirely. That's true.
And we just finished producing, our demographer finished producing the population overview, which is a very detailed report on population demographics for the state. And we look at the numbers migration that we were looking at earlier for areas of the state where there's been negative out-migration for a number of years. They tend to be areas where fishing is an important industry.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, thanks, Senator Stedman. Senator Bundy?
On that topic, and maybe this question is more accurately directed at Department of Revenue, would you have information about the net return to the state from the fishing industry?
That probably is a question more appropriately given to the Department of Revenue.
Thank you.
Other questions from the finance or visiting senators? Senator Hoffman?
One more question. Can you get a chart as similar to the first one on the job growth of state workers?
Yes.
Yes.
Senator Dyson? And maybe as a subset of that, of other government workers, federal and municipal. Senator Huffman, which chart were you looking at?
First one. Growth. Job growth. Yes, that one.
This one? Okay. Senator Kenny? All right. Other questions? Senator Dyson? And sorry, it's job security here for you. But
I'll remember that.
No, it's not a threat. Because what you do is very, very valuable. But when we talk about the federal workers, if you could break out the ones that are DOD and military.
We could do that.
Yeah, we can find that.
Okay, because thank you. Other questions? Senator Bundy.
Well, and I can see some value of the time frame of that would go back to the 80s and to the present. I noticed that during the 80s, the drop they had indicated some loss of government employment, and that was before we had tried to cut any budget.
Other questions or comments? In closing, I've had the pleasure and a couple of times to be in different meetings where Neil has come and shared his look at Alaska. And he takes, he's been rather restrained today, and he didn't have to be, but he is today. And I can tell you that in other venues, he is very entertaining and very enjoyable. And when people look at the meeting, they say, oh God, an economist. And when they leave, he has a certain flavor and a way of delivering that people, he's a good teacher. And so those that are looking for a good program for a chamber or Kiwanis or Rotary or your PTA, whatever, you should get a hold of him because he does an excellent job and people actually learn and they enjoy while they're learning. So we appreciate your service. You've been across the state, delivered a great message and helped all of us understand something that we tend to think has two heads and it doesn't. So thank you. Anything else? Thanks for being with us. Senator Dyson.
Just kind of are you familiar, sir, with the Laffer curve?
Yes.
Do you laugh when you use it?
No comment.
Do you think that there's historical data that proves that there's validity to his presuppositions? And particularly as applies to Alaska.
That would be really hard to apply to Alaska. Those are big macroeconomic ideas.
Could we anticipate that they may apply as we look at different taxing schemes for increasing revenue?
I really don't know.
Neither do I. Thank you.
Neither do any of us. All right, anything else? Thank you, Ben, for being with us today and sharing your thoughts. Let's see, we're going to bring back to the table SJR 3, and you have before you Vision Baker,
need a sectional analysis.
I'm sorry, Grayson.
You join us? So let's stand at ease for just a moment while we get our paper. May it please come back to order. We have before us committee substitute for SJR 3, version B. Chair will entertain a motion to adopt B as our working document.
Mr. Chairman, I would move version B, SJR number 3 for our working document today.
Is there objection to adopting version B? Seeing none, it is our working document. Senator Dyson.
Yeah, thank you. The iterations of this bill remind me of my collections of Bibles. And I would have told you previous to this morning that what you had was this standard version, but some great minds have even thought of some helpful improvements to what I thought would be our very best part. But what I've done since we were before the committee last, in a new version, I have eliminated the fractions in front of the population number and the inflation number, and I was persuaded by Dr. Polson's comments that it would be, even though I could make a case for it, that using unity on those factors will still be a significant restrain on growth. And so that's one change. And we see that's in the section 16, line 10 and following on page 1. Under the exemptions, which is on page 2, we added one at the suggestion of Ms. Fuska, that the permanent fund, inflation proofing, and dedicated funds and trust funds were added, and I think that those are useful. On
which ones are those?
Sorry,
which lines?
Page 2.
Mm-hmm. What page? Okay, thank you.
And we also cleaned up the language there on the first page where it said that the inflation factor can't exceed the growth in personal income. Looking to the unusual but historic situation we had back in 1980 when inflation was rampant and didn't reflect the actual what was going on in the economy. And I think Ms. Fresca's early suggestion that we factor in the growth in personal income was a valuable one, and we put it here as a limit not to be exceeded by the inflation factor. We also added, let's see, I think it's on page 2, in anticipation of when we might have an unusual circumstance that wasn't fitting into the usual definition of, we're on page 2, about line 23 and following, the unusual circumstance when we needed to spend quite a bit of money, but it wouldn't fit into the classic definition of what an emergency was. And what I'm thinking there of is a ramp up that we might have to do for a major project like a gas line or the railroad expansion. And we would want to be building infrastructure, training workers, and so on. So we follow Connecticut's language there and anticipating that, as I remember here, the definition of what would be an extraordinary circumstance would be defined in law, and to some degree is already. And then we followed Ms. Fresca's example, and dropped out the paragraph there that gave the governor the responsibility of cutting back the budget if the legislature, in my view, had acted irresponsibly and submitted a budget higher. What we're back to now is exactly what we have in existing law, the governor's veto power. And I think Senator Green has a question.
Which line are you referring to? It was a deleted section. So
yeah, a deleted section.
Thank you. It was prior language. It was on that. Okay.
I believe those are the changes we have made. And then Senator Green has raised a couple of questions that I think are excellent and that we will work on. Senator Huffman?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. In your testimony the other day, when we were looking at the X version, you mentioned that we were looking at appropriations in the prior 2 years, and I couldn't find that in the X version, and I don't see that in this version as well. And I was wondering, you said that you made that those changes, and I was wondering where they were, since you had stated that.
Yeah, and I either misspoke or we got confused in translation, but it's actually the 3 years. So if you're looking,
you said the 3 years as well, 3 year average, but there was a prior 2 years that you talked about as well as a 3 year average.
I think the confusion is that we don't look at the prior year, we go back and look at 2 years, 3 years, and 4 years previous to give us the average there. Because the immediate prior year, we don't have all the data. So you go back to the second, third, and fourth year. You see that in line 12,
page
1?
Line 12. The other calculation, I guess, that I would like to see is for the last 10 years, going back, what the price, consumer price index that you've listed in this last version, how that would compare in numbers to the budget for at least the last decade, so we can get an idea of how close our current system is following, and would our budget be larger or smaller using these calculations?
If I may, sure. Was that something that you could get fairly readily?
Sure. I think in fact Lucky may already have it. Let's finance provided, right, Lucky? Is that
we nice? Have. We, for the record, my name is Lucky Schultz, aide to Senator Dyson. We do have a graph from 1997. Going prior to 1997 is difficult because of the different categories of expenses and appropriations. But Ledge Finance has provided a graph for us that should be in the packet that we provided the other day.
Looks like this.
Three graphs on the page. It does a number of things for us. One of the things it does, I'll wait till you find it. It's
hang on just one second. Okay, let us skip that in front of us. Put our packets here somewhere.
It's prior to the large legislative research report and the other report that.
And the other question that I have, even with all the changes that we've made here, these predictions back are the same, these calculations would be the same with all the versions that we've changed. These numbers that were provided previously would be unchanged. That is my question.
Yeah. I think that's an excellent question, and we'll get that for you.
Senator Bundy. In this same general area, I think you mentioned earlier that had we had a spending limit in place, and if the monies then had been excess monies been put into the constitutional budget reserve or the permanent fund, one or the other, I guess it was the permanent fund would be substantially larger. Is there a graph in existence that show not only the impact?
Senator Bundy, you get closer to that.
Oh, I'm sorry. Is there a graph in existence that would show also the impact toward, I guess, the positive side had we had this in
existence.
No, but we're different.
Okay. Lucky or Cheryl, anything to add to what we have here?
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Cheryl Fresca, Director OMB. It's really come a long way, and I think it's becoming a very workable framework. There is a couple of suggestions, primarily in response to some of the comments in Senator Green's email. So whenever you want to work on other things, mm-hmm. be glad to offer them then.
Okay. Senator Dyson? Were you going to say something?
Well, when we get down with the question here, I'm going to suggest that we let Cheryl comment on those. I think Senator Green has raised some excellent points. Senator Huffman?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And the other question that I had, there was some discussion the other day about having this sunset and or have a second look at how this is working, a period of 6 years, 8 years, or whatever. And where was that language again?
And we did add on line 14, page 3, that it would be come up on a ballot again every 4 years. And that really forces us to take a look and see if this is working, and if indeed we find that it is an unbearable restraint on doing what good policy would have us to do, we'll have a chance to look at it. I think 4 years would probably give us a good look.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Why don't we have Cheryl give her presentation, and then we'll bring it back to questions.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just one comment on page 2, line 14. This is where we, in terms of the exclusion, this is where it gets really interesting in terms of what you might exempt from the spending limit. And I think the concern here is things that we now categorize as statutory designated program receipts, you know, a gift, a bequest, a grant, or even a contract that the state gets, an agency gets, to deliver a specific service. And I don't think we want to exclude those. We want to allow departments the latitude to receive those monies and not have it have to displace other spending. And this speaks to what Senator Green's concern was in the email that she sent regarding the statutory designated program receipts that was part of the pro-share, fair-share issue in the Department of Health and Social Services. Those are considered receipts under a contractual agreement. So if you wanted to use language on line 14 that says something like, of money from gifts, grants, bequests, or contracts, which is the same language we use for statutory designated program receipts to the state for purposes specified by the terms of those gifts, grants, bequests, or contracts. I think that then helps broaden it a little bit, but still keeps it kind of narrow. That made a lot of sense, I realize. In terms of on that reconsideration, on page 3, it does prescribe on line 13 that the Lieutenant Governor shall place the same 2004 proposition on the ballot every 4 years. I think the reason to go back and look at it is so that if it needs to be changed, if there's something that's happened, the legislature might want to have the latitude to make those necessary changes. So instead of prescribing that it be the exact same limit on the ballot in 4 years, you might want to have a limit on the ballot in 4 years. Sort of allowing the latitude there, so that would be one possibility. Otherwise, those are my comments right now.
Thank you, Cheryl. Questions from finance members? So what?
Not a question, but a concern, I guess. And on page 1, where we're talking, section 1, we're talking about the average annual percentage. Lines 10 and 11, where we're talking about the average annual percentage of the consumer price index for urban consumers of Anchorage. When we're talking about growth in Alaska's government, Anchorage's consumer price index or inflation is always way lower than many rural areas of the state. And I guess that in itself won't give a true index of what the inflation is of all Alaska. You know, although Anchorage may encompass a vast majority, it will still always be lower, given the fact that the costs in rural Alaska seem to change more rapidly than urban areas. And the second concern that I have is on line 13, where it says 13, 14, and 15, where it says not to exceed the average percentage change of the personal income of state residencies, where we're tying these the rate of increase to how successful the bargaining units are in the state of Alaska. And you know, their incomes, average incomes, are directly related to how successful the bargaining units become. And to put that type of language in the Constitution, and how our spending limit will be directly linked to the success of negotiations of the unions, it gives me a little bit of heartburn.
Yeah, I'm not sure I'll speak to the increased CPI, but I raised the same questions, and as I remember, the arguments are that because it's half the population and because it's so difficult to calculate, you know, the data for the CPI and other areas, that this was kind of a fallback position just because of the difficulty, but it still ends up being quite accurate. And I would, and on your second question, I would add that not only is the state spending driven by things that, like bargaining contracts that can be volatile, but also the Medicaid, Medicare changes and the changes in the cost of health care, you know, are also pretty volatile components of our state spending. But, Cheryl, can you comment on both?
Thank you, through the chair. Senator Hoffman, the reason that the data that's used for the Anchorage CPI is reported by the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics, and that is the only measure that is reported that relates to Alaska, so that's why it's the common one.
I understand that, but again, that still does not answer the question, will this be a fair indicator of our of inflation in Alaska in general? And I would venture to say it would not be. And if it is not, why are we tying our growth rate to that when we don't know that it is? And from my perception, it isn't. So it isn't a true indicator of inflation in Alaska.
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, right now it is the only reported indicator. So the challenge would be to come up with some other one to do that. And the idea here is not to, the challenge is to have an appropriation limit that sets a ceiling on the amount that state spending or state government can grow from one year to the next. And so it's not a precise science. And you're right in terms of reflecting what's been going on. In terms of the state contracts for state employees, as Neil Freed's presentation indicated, there's about 300,000 people employed in Alaska, working in Alaska, if I recall his data correctly, of which about 19,000 are state employees.
And I guess my comment is, with this language, you're erring on the lower end that could potentially cause problems, and not even on the mean average, and or potentially, if you had the high, the medium, and the low, with this language, you're erring on the low end of growth.
Senator Dyson?
Yeah,
and that concern is part of what drove me to take off the 0.9 that was in front of the inflation, because I think that you could argue quite successfully that the requirement for delivering state services doesn't go forward lockstep with the change in the CPI. And so, anticipating, And I think the 0.9 would have been the low end of it, and moving it up to unity gives us a more generous limit that I felt would help take advantage of the fact that, or take into account the fact that delivering services in rural areas does inflate faster than it does in the major urban center. So an attempt to take that into account. And if you can make a case and convince the committee there ought to be 1.1 times the inflation rate, you know, I personally would be, you know, very open to coming up with the most accurate figure we can. I can't defend the 0.9, and if you can defend and give us a rational case for a better number, I'm very open to that, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Stevens?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And maybe this, Ms. Fraska answered part of it, but perhaps it's a question maybe we could get Mr. Freed to give us the data on in regards to Mr. Hoffman's question on the number of members in a collective bargaining unit as regards to his percentage change in average personal income. I think it'd be good to know how many workers in the state are members of collective bargaining units, whether it be state or private employment or union membership outside state government. And maybe we could get them to show us that to see what a percentage of the workforce that would be and that, what kind of impact that would have on the change. I personally don't think it would be that big, but maybe he could help us with the statistics.
Lucky.
And on that point, Mr. Chairman, if it is not that big, then why should we even have the language in here where it says but not to exceed? And maybe why is that language placed in here?
Okay.
Not to exceed language.
Through the chair, let me address out of Canada. If you look at the chart, we all have it now. One of the things we asked Ledge Finance to look at was population and CPI, and also population and CPI, keeping CPI below personal income. Again, they can only go back to 1997 at this point, or FY97. And if you look at the chart, there is no difference between with income restriction at this point. The reason the language is in there is if you went back to 1980s, where inflation was well above the double digit in the high teens, that would have been a concern for our appropriations limit. But from 1997 to FY05, the two are really the same. There is no restriction based on personal income. If I may continue with this chart while we have it in front of us, we show three different aspects of fixing the base year here, primarily one of just picking a base year of FY96, and then a three-year floating average for the variables in all three cases. The difficulty with doing this, even though the chart looks more favorable for us, is that there is a ratchet down effect that we would decline for the first couple of years, and that has been demonstrated in other states to have a negative impact on the state economy. So we looked at doing a base year 2 years prior rather than just fixing a base year on FY96. And that shows us the second chart, which then has a sawtooth effect that Mr. Teal showed us some time ago, where it's hard to determine or predict what the limit would be for the following year. So we went to the third chart that shows the base year of average over 3 years, along with the averaging of of the variables. And then you have a much more predictable limit, resulting in just about the same limit in FY05 as you would if you had just the base year 2 years ago, but a much more predictable limit, which should be more attractive to both businesses and the residents. Senator Hutton?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. But the reason that I asked for a 10-year span was these years include the $250 million reduction that we had. We were under, the legislature was under a plan for not only holding government spending level, but for a 5-year period, we were under guidelines to reduce government by $250 million. So it's hard for me to put any faith in these numbers when they include, you know, that time frame, because that does not give us a true indicator of growth in government. That would again give us the lower standard of one of the lowest standards of growth in Alaska's history.
And if I may respond, Mr. Chairman, would you like us to get a chart that would have shown what it would have been like if we'd have approved the governor's budgets as submitted, which I think would have added about $1 billion to the GF? I can sure get that for you, sir.
Well, I'd rather have actuals going back, you know, to go ahead and look at something that we didn't act on doesn't give us a true indicator of growth, you know, and it would be easier to look at, you know, a 10-year span. You know, I'm not interested in looking at a hypothetical that never existed.
I think we could produce for you what it would have been if there hadn't been the $250 million reduction that this legislature worked on. That we could do all three, what actually happened, or what it was actually happened, what the 250, without the $250 million reduction, and with the something like $1 billion that the governor suggested.
Senator Bundy?
Yeah, regarding the $250 million reduction, as I remember it, the sixth year of the five-year plan added that $250 million back, so maybe there's a net zero there, I don't know.
And I'd like to look
not a statistician, but that may reduce the concern about not being an accurate picture. And regarding the Anchorage CPI being used as a base, you might check this. Assuming it was accurate, I believe the officials from the Port of Anchorage indicate that the Port of Anchorage serves something like 80% of Alaska. And so if indeed 80% of Alaska's economy is dependent on what's going on through Anchorage, maybe that CPI has some more validity than the concerns might indicate.
And certainly that it may be, I think Senator Hoffman raises a valid point. One of the reasons it was attractive to me to take the federal published results was that it eliminates the criticism and perhaps in rare cases the fact that a state government might tilt the scales on what the calculations were for the going forward with a state-sponsored agenda. So some administration, certainly not this one or the last one, but one in the future, might indeed encourage the calculation to be that which would either allow more spending or not. And at least going to the federal standard gives the impression of an objective one that we can't influence, or the administration couldn't.
Senator Green?
When we were on version Y, my staff had done...
Senator, work. A little closer to that.
When we were on version Y, my staff had done a 10-year look back and done the statistical analysis for population inflation and the averaging of the per capita income with that as well, and compared that growth per year. And with the current version, it's my assumption it wouldn't be that difficult to transfer and update this to a version B and also include what the average state appropriation was for us to give us the information that Senator Hoffman's talking about. And it was interesting, though, we were talking about in some ways how steady some of these numbers are, and in other ways when you start adding information in how volatile they get. And so I think you'll be interested in seeing the chart when it comes out, because it's pretty interesting to see. And it also has a legend of some of the definitions of things that are referred to that we forget what they are. And so it helps. So we'll get that to everyone.
You're looking over my shoulder here, Tracy, is she nodding?
She's going,
I want to make sure somebody's back there nodding.
She said, I think she said this.
Senator Dyson and then Senator Stevens.
Yeah, thank you. And I believe Senator Stedman has done some work and produced a chart, and I think it might be useful in this discussion to have him explain that to us.
I think before we would do that, I think we want to get his charts to reflect the current B version, because his charts are back at the 0.9 and the 0.75. That sound right?
They were like the previous alphabet.
Yeah, we're back in the prior alphabet. Is that all right, Senator Dyson? Senator Stevens.
Yeah, this is again in regard to Mr. Hoffman's comments about using the Anchorage CPI indicator, and since state spending in various forms in terms of payroll and government allocations for various other regions are all benchmarked on the Anchorage rates, wouldn't that in effect be reflective if you have an adjustment that takes place in Anchorage, then you apply the geodifferential, wouldn't that be included into the rural areas? It seems to me it would be.
I'm not sure there's a way to get where Senator Hoffman wants to get.
But I mean, what I'm saying is, if the Anchorage benchmark has been adjusted for the inflation rate, and then the geodifferential is added to the various other forms of government spending in other areas of the state, it would be reflected. It is reflected through the geodifferential.
We can
probably
try to sort out CPIs.
What about looking at, you know, if you take a look at the breadbasket measures, which is done, you know, in Anchorage, Fairbanks, Juneau, Bethel, Nome, you know, that I think gives me more comfort if something like that could be tied in here, because that shows more. You know, although it only shows the grocery end of it, shows more of the cost of living, because I look at those breadbasket statistics, and it shows that for $1 worth of groceries in Anchorage, it cost $1.80 in Bethel and $1.90 in Nome. And, you know, that, I guess, is the concern that I have. And although the budgets already exist out there, the higher rates for the correctional officers, like in Bethel, are, I think, 1.3 times those that are in Anchorage. But, you know, it just still leaves me some discomfort knowing the difference in cost of living in Anchorage versus the cost of living in rural areas of the state.
Other discussion? Senator
Dyson. I think we probably got most of it said here on this issue, but remember that the cost, what the